Today is February 11th, 2014. My name is Dr. Alan Peterson, representing the Edward Hand Medical Heritage Foundation, Vaccine Farms Incorporated, as well as the Journal of Lancaster General Health. With us today are Dr. Lawrence Bonchek, editor of the Journal of Lancaster General Health, and Mrs. Ulrika Goldstein, managing editor of the journal. Today we have the true honor and privilege of talking with Dr. Alan Bernstein, who received a PhD in medical microbiology from the University of Pennsylvania. He is retired from Wyeth in 1987, and he now resides in retirement with his wife in Willow Street. Welcome, Dr. Bernstein.
Thank you.
Can you briefly describe your childhood and early life, as well as influences that steered you toward a life in biomedical research?
My first interest in microbiology or bacteriology was in 1933. I was about 7 years of age, and I had just seen the movie Louis Pasteur that was played by Paul Mooney, a renowned actor at the time. And the story sort of attracted me, and for some reason I always, when an adult would ask me what I want to be, I would always say a bacteriologist. There was no other reason other than the movie. My next encounter was in 1943. I was a senior in high school in Brooklyn, New York. And the war was, World War II was in progress, and the New York City schools were offering defense courses for the seniors. And these were a variety of courses, and the students selected the course they wanted to pursue. I pursued a laboratory course, which reviewed or went through all the basic procedures and terminology of a, as I remember, a clinical laboratory. When it came to bacteria, we had an exercise of growing bacteria on agar plates. The school provided the agar plates. This is the surface on which you grow bacteria or are able to grow bacteria. My interest was spurred to the level that I bought some bacteriological media and made some bacteriological media in my home. Using potato slants. These were baking potatoes that were cut in a cylinder and then with a and then cut with a slope so you increase the surface of growing the bacterium. I got a sample of a culture of Serratia marcescens, which is a red bacteria, from my high school instructor, and I inoculated these various media, and for a heat source I used a heating lamp in my bedroom, and I kept on monitoring the heat with a household thermometer and watching it during the night. And I did that for about a year. And I guess I graduated high school and started my college career at Brooklyn College. Just about the time after I registered for school, I joined the Navy. I was about 17 years of age, and I wasn't called for active duty until September of 1943. I went to boot camp in Sampson, New York. And from Sampson, New York, I was transferred to the hospital corps of the Navy. I don't know why I was selected, whether something in my history indicated an interest in medicine or not. But I went to corps school, which is basically a nursing school, and was exposed to all the nursing techniques and philosophies. In March of 1944, I was transferred to the U.S. Navy Hospital in Philadelphia, in which I was first assigned a sick officer's quarters and did general nursing and floor swabbing. And night duty. The Philadelphia Naval Hospital specialized in amputees, and these were people that were getting prosthesis or getting skin grafts to heal their stumps and whatnot. The next tour of duty at Naval Hospital was to work for a surgeon, plastic surgeon, who was preparing skin grafts, and I would change dressings for that. Then received, after about 6 months or so, I received orders to go to epidemiology school in Bethesda. I didn't know what the word epidemiology meant, and I thought it had something to do with skin, because that's what I was doing in Philadelphia. When we arrived in Bethesda at the Navy Medical School, they explained to us, which also included MDs as well as corpsmen, that they oversubscribed the course, and they would give an exam to reduce the number of eligible students. I was with a buddy, and both of us decided that we wouldn't pass the course because the war was just about over, and we didn't want to have a technical rating to keep us in service. At the last minute, for some reason, I told my buddy I'm going to try and pass the exam, which I did. This was a very fortuitous decision, which I don't know why I made. And this course turned out to be the basic for my career. It included bacteriology, parasitology, entomology, epidemiological mathematics, and a couple of other courses. I enjoyed it tremendously, and I don't recall whether there was an exam or not at the end, but my orders read from there to join a research team under the Bureau of Medicine at Great Lakes Naval Training Center. And the objective of this research was the control of streptococcal infections in the barracks of the recruits by use of ultraviolet light, that's at 25-37 angstroms. and oiling of the decks. We did throat cultures and pig cultures. We did air sampling, and we counted bacteria, counted strep. And at the conclusion of the study, which was somewhere, let's see, in July of 46, we had a conference, and the Navy invited all the renowned bacteriologists, Elaine Updike, who was the grand dam for streptococcal infections. I had the pleasure of meeting her. And the name Stuart Mudd popped up. He was the head of the bacteriology department at University of Pennsylvania. And I picked him up at the airport and took him back to the airport at the conclusion of the seminar. I was discharged in 46, and I just had 1 year of college and tried to return to college, but all the colleges, it was difficult to get into any school. And I went to Philadelphia, developed a area college for students who would go to school late in the afternoon and during the evening, and the faculty was made up of professors from all around Philadelphia. I had some of the best prestigious professors teach. I finally was able to enter Philadelphia College of Pharmacy and Science in South Philadelphia, or King's Essence Street. And they offered a course in bacteriology, and there were, I think, there were about 10 students who were in the bacteriology course, and two of us were bacteriologists in the service. I took a part-time job in Children's Hospital. I volunteered to work in the laboratory gratis, and in short order, they found money to pay me. I worked weekends, and eventually I worked during the summer. The the pathologist in charge of the laboratory at Children's Hospital was Dr. Irving Woolman. And my duties after they had confidence in me that I can make methylene blue stain in a 5-gallon jug. This is interesting, reminding myself of these things. I did throat cultures, nasopharynx cultures, spinal fluid cultures, ovum parasite examinations, did some milk bacteriology for Dr. Woolman. I was there for till 1951. in that laboratory. In my senior year, I was reminded by the Navy that I was still in the reserves, and they called me back for Korea when I asked for an extension to finish, to graduate college. They granted me an extension, and about 6 months before I graduated, I got another call from the shore patrol saying that I was AWOL, and I should have reported for duty in January of that year. And they sent me up to New York to be chastised. And I was admonished to go to the Navy office and apply for a commission, which I never did. They discharged me because they ran out of time to call me back to Korea. In the meantime, Dr. Woolman tried to get me into medical school, and the class was full, and I couldn't get in that year. There was a Dr. M.M. Siegel in the research department at Children's Hospital. He was a virologist. And I told him my plight, and he says, no problem. He has a Navy contract for research, and he'd be glad to take me on as a research student, which he did. And my career started at that point as a virologist. The work I was involved in was the investigation of the interaction of a virus called meningopneumonitis virus, which is part of a psittacosis lymphogranuloma group of viruses, and Krebs 2 carcinoma, which is a mouse ascites tumor. And after a couple of, a year or so, Dr. Siegel decided to was offered a job at the Communicable Disease Center in Montgomery, Alabama. And he had a commitment to give me a job if I wanted to go with him. I had an option. The research department at Children's Hospital included Dr. Henley's, Gertrude and Verna. And Dr. Henley and his wife was involved in influenza research. And he said, if I went with him, I would have to start my research program all over again with influenza. And I was married, and we had a child on the way. So we decided to go to Montgomery, Alabama. The medical officer in charge of the virus and rickettsia section in Montgomery was Dr. Morris Schaefer, a well-known microbiologist and pediatrician from New York. My first set of duties was the preparation and maintenance of tissue cell cultures, which was a brand new discipline. Although the history of tissue cultures go back to 1920 with Alexis Carrel and, surprisingly, Charles Lindbergh. Also, I was assigned work that involved the isolation and identification of polioviruses and Coxsackie viruses. Coxsackie viruses is named after the town Coxsackie in New York, and involves enteric disease. And also I had a crack at an electron microscope. I learned how to use it, but never successfully. I became in charge of the laboratory for the 1954 evaluation of the Salk vaccine. There were various laboratories throughout the United States that would receive serum samples, and we would do serologic neutralization tests on samples to determine whether there was a conversion to immune status. Our area was Florida. Then I became acting in charge of the virus diagnostic laboratory. I supervised virus isolation, serologic studies, mostly complement fixation tests. I became assistant in charge of the virus in our diagnostic laboratory in May of 1956. Morris Schaefer brought in an established virologist by the name of Cy Coulter, whose fame originally was cat scratch fever. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
He was a great proponent that it was a virus. I also supervised a laboratory in the evaluation of the potency test for poliovirus vaccine, namely Salk. This was a test done in monkeys, done by the manufacturer, as well as the Division of Biologic Standards, which eventually became FDA. And so it was a joint study with FDA and the Communicable Disease Center. During my stay at CDC, I participated in lectures and laboratory courses presented by CDC, and they were held either at CDC or state health laboratories. Then in July 1957, I was transferred to Chamblee, Georgia, which is just outside of Atlanta, to head up a new unit, the Diagnostic Reagent Section. One of the problems that we faced in public health work is that the state laboratories weren't geared up and didn't know enough about virus diagnostic work and didn't have the tools, that is, the reagents, the tool, that were standardized and were reliable. So I was responsible for developing standards for rickettsia viruses, bacteria, fungi, and parasites. And early in 1958, I met Dr. Howard Tint, who was an employee of Wyeth. He was the head of the Biologic Product Development Unit in Radnor. And I had a conversation with him, and we were planning, our family was planning to take a vacation trip to Philadelphia, and I asked him whether I could visit a pharmaceutical laboratory since I had never seen one, and he granted me. And sometime in that spring we met, he gave me a tour of the Radnor facility and told me about the laboratory out in Marietta and indicated that he had need for a virologist. During that period of time, the civil rights movement was just about beginning in the South, and there was a lot of serious talk about discontinuing the public school system and going to a private school system, and our children were just approaching school age. So as a family, we made a decision we were going to leave the South, and so I accepted Dr. Tint's offer for a job in Philadelphia, or Philadelphia area, knowingly that if I didn't like it there are a lot of other facilities in the Philadelphia, New Jersey, New York area for positions, and there weren't too many virologists floating around. So in August of 1958, my family moved to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. The job offer was for Marietta. The title was Supervisor of Biologic Product Development Unit. You want to give me a minute rest?
It seems to have been a tradition of hiring University of Pennsylvania veterinarians at the Marietta site. Would you say this perception was accurate for an extensive period at
You want to go back two questions.
I thought you had given us
I just got there.
All right. How would you describe your path to Wyeth Pharmaceuticals and the Marietta site in Lancaster County?
Okay. Well, my first day was memorable. We had gotten an apartment in Lancaster, and my first impression was this beautiful old farm building, frame building, two-story, with all the paraphernalia around. Just beautiful. And there was a little alcove to the left in which there was a telephone operator who was handicapped and was in a wheelchair, and she had a old-fashioned switchboard with all these wires going thing. And that just impressed me. Then there was a long, curved, wide staircase carpeted to the middle, from the middle. And I went upstairs and spoke to a secretary, and I was introduced to Dr. John Brown, who was the managing director of the facility. And Dr. Howard Tent was with him. Of course, Dr. Howard Tent introduced me. And we had a brief talk about the trip and whatnot. And then I went over to the facility. Was there were some new brick buildings, rather big, and there was some white stucco buildings. They were all separated. The lawn was green, and there were sidewalks to walk on. And there were a couple of other wood frame buildings scattered in the facility. I was taken to a brick building, which was housed the Biological Product Development Group. Now, I think it would be appropriate to set what Wyeth considered the Biological Product Development and where they were anchored. They came from Radnor, that is Dr. Tent, and he had some technician, had one PhD, Dr. Stone, working for him in Marietta. And this was a brick building which they did the early work on Salk polio vaccine. And there were two technicians, high school graduates, and one college graduate technician. And their prime work at that time was developing adenovirus vaccine. That was a relatively new virus, or newly discovered. And they were learning how to grow it in monkey kidney tissue cell cultures, and they were measuring the amounts of virus that they grew by titering in monkey kidney cells. And that was the development. Now, the other responsibility that the Biological Product Development Group had at Marietta was that if production had a problem, that is, biological production had a problem, they would help the production people. Now, at that point of time, the facility was manufacturing they were manufacturing Salk vaccine in another building. They made tetanus toxoid, tetanus toxin, and then toxoid it. They made cholera, made diphtheria, again going from toxin to toxoid, combining the four combined products. They made a product called anti-venene, which was called for the immunizing of horses with venom, Kurtalid venom. And they were making smallpox vaccine in heifers. Now, production, there may be a few other products that just escaped my mind at the moment. Production was not continuous. It was done sort of in groups. They would make some diphtheria, store it, then go make some tetanus, store it, and that went for all the products. Howard Tent, when he assigned me, he never really assigned me any specific duties. He says, learn it, which was necessary because I had no prior experience with this. So I got out reprints and examined cultures and stuck my nose into everybody's business, including routine production. Eventually, or within the year, a PhD virologist came to Wyeth. That was Dr. Rubin. I had known him before, and he was the one that designated me as manager of biological product development in Marietta. I don't know where he got the authority for it, but that became my title. And for the better part of 5 years, I was going and doing a lot of various things and helping people, learning. There was no really active work happening. Oh, yes, there was. I'm sorry. Around 1959-1960, Sabin had gotten approval of his strains for use for polio immunization. Now, granting Sabin approval to use the strains had no bearing on the manufacturer. Each manufacturer had to qualify his own production by making 5 successive lots of his strains, the 3 strains. And so we started in qualifying the vaccine, and we were using cynomolgus monkeys instead of rhesus monkeys because of simian virus problems. In addition to qualifying 5 lots, the 5 lots had to be clinically tested, that is, administered. And the people monitored for indication of adverse effects and also the conversion of their immune status. That took several years to accomplish, and then eventually Sabin vaccine, we qualified for a license, and we started manufacturing a Sabin vaccine. Now, during that period of time, Wyeth was engaged in, or had been making smallpox vaccine going back to about 1880. About 1965, Wyeth established a freeze-dried procedure for the manufacture of smallpox vaccine. Now, I avoid the use of develop because in reality, there was a graduate student in England who published a paper on the freeze-drying of smallpox vaccine. And it was not protected by any patent law, so anybody could copy the procedure and make the product and sell it. And that's what the product development group did. We got a license, well, we had a license, and it was still being made by the manufacturing group. When Dr. Tint developed or utilized the freeze-dried method, it was turned over to manufacturing people to do it. Now, I'll digress for a moment, and this will apply for all manufacturing. All manufacturing's products are described in a manufacturing manual. It includes all the specifications for the ingredients, treatment of ingredients, characterization of the ingredients, if there are any in-process testing to be done, that is identified, the final product is tested and qualified, the filled product is tested and qualified, and the packaged product is tested and qualified. This applies to all the products made at Marietta. Shortly after Dr. Tint's modification of the freeze-dried procedure, I was encountering some problems with potency, and I reviewed our potency problem and manufacture, and I found that we could improve the yield and the potency, which I did. And then I went through a testing scheme to establish the quality of the change in procedure. At the same time, I also changed the potency testing for the product. The product was before that was tested in rabbits in a rather crude test. It was scarify the skin of a rabbit, and you would get a mathematical expression based on the confluency of the lesions. The use of the chorioallantoic membrane to quantify smallpox viruses or pox viruses had been well established. And the use of tissue cultures also was newly established. I developed, in my study, I compared all four methods, that is the rabbit scarification, the CAM, and the tissue culture test. That would be three procedures. And on that basis, submitting that data to FDA, on that basis, we were able to change the potency test to a more quantitative assay procedure. And that established that the new method of making vaccine was superior to what we had been doing. And that became the standard for the product. The product had a unique characterization. the dried product before use was reconstituted with a diluent and used. The bifurcated needle was not quite developed, and so the regular pointed needle, conventional needle, was used to administer the vaccine at that time, about 1960. Our study indicated that the reconstituted vaccine, that is with the diluent, if kept in the refrigerator at its coldest point, could maintain potency for 90 days in the refrigerator. That was a significant achievement or use for local docs who would only have maybe two or three immunizations, a smallpox immunization, in a week's time. And the smallest dose that was available was a 10-dose container. So instead of throwing the stuff away, the doc all had to put it into a freezer, into a refrigerator, and use it for up to 90 days. Around 1960, thereabouts, Dr. Schaefer, who had now become director of laboratories in New York City, informed us or inquired of Wyeth whether they could supply a stockpile of smallpox vaccine for New York City's use. New York City had a law on the books that mandated the availability of a stockpile. This was done, and then we would rotate the stockpile with fresh production material, so it would never go out of date, and testing was done at the appropriate time. After about 5 or 6 years of this, Dr. Dr. Schaefer told us that we can discontinue the stockpile. He had the law changed, and we could keep the stockpile. Dr. Brown had the thought that wouldn't this be nice to continue as a national stockpile? And he went down to CDC and he had difficulty trying to convince them that this was the best thing to do. They finally did, and Wyeth continued the stockpile. And this was the stockpile that was the backup for 9/11 crisis. During this period of time, WHO had been thinking about a worldwide eradication program for smallpox, and they enticed or got CDC to undertake a study in Western Africa and West Central Africa using Wyeth's vaccine and a measles vaccine, and which was very successful in terms of eradication. So that was the beginning of the eradication program. Now, there were during the following years, let's see, there were other products being developed, and they were usually under the guide of biological product development. There was a rabies vaccine, a tissue culture vaccine that was developed by Dr. Tint's group. They were, as I was involved in producing cholera toxin, there were a group of scientists, one from Texas, Dr. Finkelstein, and there was one from Long Island University Medical School, whose name escapes me. And they had a theory that cholera the cholera disease was involved with a toxin. And what they asked Wyeth to do was to make the toxin according to their formula and just provide it to them as a research tool. One of Wyeth's scientists developed an interest in this product, and she started making a toxin her own way. And it never went any. It ended up no different than the initial cholera toxin. And the conclusion was the cholera toxin played no role in the cholera disease, and the study was abandoned. There was an interest in rotavirus. A license was obtained, and then shortly after it was licensed, there was some clinical problems with the vaccine, and Wyeth withdrew the product. In 1968, or 65 or thereabouts, Wyeth allowed me to participate in the World Health Organization program, the smallpox eradication program. It was to be for a short period of time as a consultant. And the reason that there was a problem or a serious problem was that most of the vaccine that was being used in the world was produced by Russia. Wyeth vaccine was only used in West Central Africa. Other countries made small amounts of vaccine and used it for their eradication program. The committee that was formed head of the committee was Dr. D.A. Anderson. I mean, this is the eradication group. He was a former CDC epidemiologist. I remember when he first came to become an epidemiology officer, he was in a class I was teaching. His assistant was Isaiah Arita, and the other members of the committee were C. Kaplan, V. Milyushin, a Russian. Kaplan was an Englishman. Hecker, Anton Hecker, was from Holland. Marinikova. S. Marinikova, Russian. Bob Wilson, Canadian. Paul Fenje, F-E-N-J-E, was Canadian. And myself were the members of the committee. We reviewed all our manufacturing procedures, discussed them. At the conclusion of the meeting in Geneva, Henderson gave me the job of writing the manual, the first draft. I think I got it because I was the youngest. And which I prepared, and we distributed, and we settled on a methodology. Then our conference went to Moscow to observe the Russian method. And I was rather shocked. This was after Sputnik, and we had such regard for the Russian technology. And we saw this old-fashioned lyophilization facility. It was the earliest form of lyophilization I've ever seen. You see it in textbooks and pictures. And then to top it all off, after the lyophilization procedure, they disconnected each vial in a room that had no air conditioning, no humidity control, and then they would stopper it. And that was it. Well, it wasn't a wonder their humidity, water content was so high that it didn't have any stability. Well, then they came to Marietta, and they saw our facility, and they apparently had corrected it. During my status as a consultant, I was asked to go to Iran. And while I was in Iran, they asked me to go to Bangladesh. The Iran situation was a boondoggle. the director of the laboratory was looking for a trip to New York City. And he would hope I would include that in my report. They made vaccine in rabbits. They tested it in rabbits. And it was very primitive. But, you know, based on their data that I saw, it was adequate. So he never got a trip to New York. My trip to Bangladesh was they had a centrifuge problem, and someone in Geneva thought Bangladesh wasn't too far away. So I spent the night outside of Calcutta, which was very shocking. And the problem was resolved in Bangladesh. I'm coming to the end of my notes, and we can proceed to your questions. Patch up anything that I may have left out that you're interested in.
Okay. There seems to have been a tradition of hiring University of Pennsylvania veterinarians at the Marietta site. Would you say this perception was accurate for an extensive period at Wyeth and Marietta?
No, that was just an accident. The founding doctor was from the medical school. His son-in-law was a veterinarian, and so the family inherited that. That was the Gilliland Laboratory. And there were a couple other vets came from there, so.
Mm-hmm. Let me just give a little bit of the history for the readers of the Marietta Biological Laboratories. It started in 1882. By Dr. H.M. Alexander and Company as Lancaster County Vaccine Farms, and that went until 1916. In 1917 through 1943, it became the Gilliland, Gilliland Laboratories. In 1943 to 2005, it became Wyeth Laboratories. And in 2005, GlaxoSmithKline, all one word, purchased the...
Glaxo purchased the property.
Right.
Okay.
Property.
Because there was something that was incorrect in the notes about Glaxo.
Okay.
Later on.
When you arrived at the Marietta site, how was the facility organized?
Well, I never saw an organization chart, but I got to know, you know, the basic things. There was a managing director, and there was a veterinarian who was in charge of biological production, and he was also in charge of the animals. And anti-venene would have included anti-venene production. And he had a veterinarian that went out and bought horses and took care of the small animals. And they had monkeys for sock vaccine, and they would take care of that. There was a pharmaceutical production unit. We had a man in charge, and then there was a quality assurance group that was chemistry and biological testing. And then, after maybe 5 or 10 years, that Animal Welfare Act came about, and so there were standards for housing and the health of animals. Then administratively, there was material management that would buy all the equipment, materials. There was a personnel group. There was a plant maintenance and security group. And there was an accountant.
Where would you position the research branch in a larger tree diagram of Wyeth and Marietta?
Well, at Marietta, there was no... Well, go back. At Radnor, there's a research department head, a vice president, that included pharmaceuticals and biologicals. He was Howard Tint's boss. And they... That research group took care of long-term problems or development, or sometimes production problems. The pharmaceutical group, they would test the quality or examine the quality of stoppers as well as the product itself. If they manufacturing ran into a precipitation problem, they would send their people out to help. There was no one in Marietta that had that skill. Then the product development group, as far as I know, I guess there was a pharmaceutical product development group that was related to product. Then before that would be research that would formulate something or other and decide what they were going to make or look for. So at Marietta, there was no pure research. I had pretty much free rein. My confidant was John Brown. My second level of confidant was Howard Tint. We would tell him, this is what we're doing. And he would always complain about it. The money comes out of his budget, not production. But he was always willing to do it. He was a great guy to work with.
That sort of answers my next question, which was, how do you describe the relationship between the bean counters and the researchers?
Oh, the bean counters, we really didn't have any close relationship. In manufacturing, they put in a standard cost system, and so they sort of predict what cost should be, and it's the deviation from the cost that you may have to answer to, but they rarely gave us a bad time.
Were you free to explore pure research as a large percentage of your time, or were your hours directed towards mainly products with more immediate commercial value?
All my research work was more or less focused directly or indirectly to product.
Were your goals in recruiting new talent? What were your goals in recruiting new talent to Wyeth?
We didn't hire too many people other than when we made influenza vaccine. Our population would go from maybe 250 to 1,000, and most of these were technicians that would handle eggs, harvest fluids from eggs. A lot of the people when I came were graduates from Elizabethtown College. And they were very capable people. The workforce at Marietta was ideal. There were family relationships. We hired relatives both to the dislike of the personnel. They don't like to hire relatives. And especially if they work for Armstrong, a unionized plant.
Wyeth Laboratories is credited with the creation of both the bifurcated needle, I guess that was in 1965, Benjamin A. Rubin, and a scarifier for the use on calves skin in Bangladesh. Can you explain the effects of these innovations on the WHO campaign?
Well, the bifurcated needle, well, you have the advantage of the bifurcated needle that you use 1/40th of the dose. You, in other words, you've expanded. It was interesting how that came about. I wasn't present at the meeting, but John Brown told me about it. They were in the office of the vice president for manufacturing, who was a veterinarian. And they were talking about a dispensing unit. And he says, you know, when we did wingweb immunization of chickens, this bifurcated needle that was used. So the idea of the bifurcated needle came from a vice president, and Ben Rubin was present at the meeting, and he took up on it. Now, he did a lot of work, but there, we were supplied by, for Tubex needles, by a company in Reading who used to make just knitting needles. Yeah. So they undertook this project, and he suggested design changes. And then Dr. Mal Bierley, who's a pediatrician for Wyeth, who was involved in biologicals and did a lot of clinical testing for biologicals. I knew him from Children's Hospital. He would do the clinical testing and make suggestions. So, in reality, the bifurcated needle was the byproduct of three or four people. Ben Rubin got the credit. He went to the patent office, Wyeth patent office, and got things started. So be it.
And do you have anything to say about the scarifier?
Yeah, the scarifier was a development of one of the head of the smallpox unit, Dave Hoover. And they had an old-fashioned scarifier, and he decided it would work better. And the idea was to scarify the surface of the wash skin of the heifer, so to minimize the amount of blood, and it worked well. We didn't make a big to-do about it.
And did it have any significant effects on the innovations of the WHO campaign?
Well, the percent of the vaccine that was used was from Russia. Whether they ever took up with that scarifier, I'll never know. I know some other labs, the one in Holland, made some units. But I don't think in itself it was any great shakes for the eradication program.
The fear of transfer of pathogens from chickens, such as avian leucosis, might have been a concern early on. Were there any attempts to monitor flocks that produced eggs for vaccine production?
Well, that question really pulled my memory. The answer was yes. We had a fellow work for a PhD named Fontes, and he's a graduate of, was a graduate of Michigan State University. And his mentor was a veterinarian who had an avian leukosis-free flock. And we became interested in it, and we got some fertile eggs, and we grew a flock, but it never went anywhere. There was never any demand for it.
Can you tell us your thoughts on the development between whole cell versus acellular pertussis vaccine?
Well, there were always two vaccines on the market. One was Wyeth vaccine that was, I think, Merck also made, and National Drug. I'm not sure for sure that they did. But there was a whole cell vaccine. And Lilly called Trisulgent, a soluble extract. And on the market, they was always treated equally. There was no advertisement that I'm aware of that would say Trisulgent was better than Wyeth DPT. There has been a change in pertussis vaccine, and someone's going to have to explain why we're having an increase in pertussis disease.
When the federal law changed the dynamic and protected producers of vaccine from some kinds of litigation, did this enable a shorter development time for some life-saving vaccines and sera?
No.
Okay. You don't have anything else to add, I guess.
No, I mean, the government did what, I can repeat the logic they pronounced. They test every product, and they set the standards, and so they took the responsibility. Now, to date, all the allegations for pertussis have not been supported by clinical data. So the fact that the government offered to pay money in lieu of lawsuit was the right step.
It seems that many corporations abandon vaccine production because of attendant legal liability. How great a role did this play in the changes that you witnessed over time at Wyeth?
Let me read that. Where was that in the second page?
Second page, about two-thirds of the way down.
Well, there was no change in Wyeth's attitude toward manufacturing.
My understanding is that your help was enlisted in 1969 as a participant in a workshop of the immunology of cholera. From the outside, it would seem that there was a worldwide research community sharing insights and results to speed life-saving solutions. Can you talk about the tensions between humanitarian efforts at global disease eradication and profit motives of corporations reporting to shareholders?
Well, I don't know when management, that is senior management, makes a decision to investigate development of a new product, what goes into that. That decision. But in terms of when there's a humanitarian need for the product, a manufacturer has always stepped forward. I think as an industry, they were very mindful of their responsibility. And for many years, the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, their structure with manufacturers was that they would have committees for specific products, for biologicals, and companies would send their people to attend these meetings. There was always a PMA member attending the meeting just to facilitate the meeting. But I was on the biological committee meeting for many, many years, and also served as chairman for 4 years. There was never any pressure. There was usually encouragement to do something if there was need for it.
Was there a specific moment that you would describe as a turning point in the vaccine production community?
In that regard, I don't think so. I mean, there were ups and downs, and Salk vaccine after the 54 field trials, the cutter incident. I mean, the government and the manufacturers all got together and investigated the problem, solved the problem, and went ahead and made the Salk vaccine.
Does it bother you that there are so few manufacturers of vaccines in the world today?
It's a shame, but if they can supply the demand, so be it.
In the sale of Wyeth Marietta site to Pfizer, much was made of the value of the Prevnar vaccine, protection against childhood meningitis and related infections. Were you involved in the research that culminated in this product? And
no. This thing is sort of mixed up.
Okay.
The property was not sold to Pfizer.
Okay.
Just the company.
Okay.
The property was sold to SmithKline. And Prevnar was a product of American Cyanamid. Literally. And I know nothing about that.
Okay. Dr. Plotkin and other giants in the history of vaccines have valiantly countered myths that connect HIV to early polio vaccine campaigns. A letter on the web that I ran across from Salk describing the cell lines of a sample he forwarded to you.
To me?
Well, again, maybe it was the other Dr. Bernstein. But I'll show you a copy of the letter. I actually have it here. Did have it here. Just put it under here for a moment. There it is. Maybe that's not you. I thought it was. Was that you?
Well, the vial of herpes virus.
Would you like to comment about the use of monkey kidney tissue in research at the Marietta site and the safeguards and protections that were in place?
Yeah, just a moment. Well, your question. He sent me herpes virus and a procedure for testing. He didn't send me any describing the cell lines of a sample he forwarded to you. Well, when you say cell lines, interpretation means tissue cell cultures. He, according to this thing, sent me some herpes virus. Well, all I say is it's possible that he did. The manufacturers of tissue culture monkey tissue culture vaccines, as well as Wyeth, were always mindful of the potential for B virus infection. Wyeth had one case, and it was very unusual. Nice meeting you. Have a good day. The industry talked about it together, and we always came up with a way of keeping quarantining monkeys, isolating monkeys, keeping people out of where monkeys are, or wearing the right garb. So we were mindful of the problem, and we took all precautions.
Do you have any particular knowledge of where the monkeys were purchased from?
Oh yeah, each one who purchases, we know the purchaser. You get a bill from the. If your question is, can I tell you what part of Africa or South America they came from? No, I can't tell you. There was the monkey of choice that initially was rhesus monkey. Then we found out about simian viruses, and we found that cynomolgus monkeys were better than rhesus. So we were very mindful of it.
Many former Wyeth employees remember the family-like community they enjoyed. If there were one thing that you would like to share with us about your career in research at Wyeth, what would it be?
Well, if the focus is on people, I think I would say of the two places I've worked different at the CDC and Wyeth. The folks at Wyeth at Marietta were the most helpful, kindest people. They're always willing to go to do anything for you. And I was always surprised about, especially at the beginning of my career, of how much they knew. And in talks, I've given credit to the Marietta people for the success I've enjoyed.
And again, could you think of any one significant achievement of yours while you worked at Wyeth that stands out in your mind?
Yeah, that was a very interesting thing I did. We were, that I've always taken pride of. What's his name? Wistar Institute. Oh, what's his name? It involved Plotkin, but what's his name? He worked for Letterly for a while. Polish name. Kaprowski. Hillary Kaprowski. Hillary had a strain of live polio that he was testing as a candidate.
For a vaccine.
For a vaccine. And he was doing studies in Africa. And there was a case where there was a polio case in a vaccinated individual, and the question, as always, was it vaccine strain or wild strain? I had read a paper by a fellow named McBride. It was a sort of a dynamic neutralization test in tissue culture. And it was done on small medicine bottles, flat, in which you measured the amount of virus absorbed onto the surface of this tissue culture system. And they would represent one virus particle. And if you did it under different time schedule, that is, allow the virus absorb for so many hours or minutes and wash it off and then incubate it, you can get a curve of virus growth. And you use serum as a neutralizing agent, that is, specific serum. And the serum, the homologous system, would neutralize more virus than the heterologous or different system. And so this technique, as I applied it, made me stay up and do this work all night long. And I wouldn't ask anybody else to do it. And I came to the conclusion that the virus was not vaccine related. It was a wild strain. And so I've always felt that little study, it took me weeks of night and no night sleeping to do the work.
Very good. What have we failed to ask, and what would you like to add to the historical record?
I enjoyed the work. Immensely, and I had a different attitude toward type of research. My first research with the meningopneumonitis virus was very theoretical. I mean, it was a virus and a cancer. When the paper was presented in New York, I think it was one of the academy meetings, I couldn't be presented because I had a lecture to give. My wife got, after the meeting, it reached the late press, virus kills cancer cells. You can well imagine. My wife got many calls from family members saying, can you help us? We have a member. And she conveyed this, of course, to me. And so I sort of, at one time, thought about, what was my effort for? And then when I got into CDC, and especially Wyeth and making vaccine, here I was making a product, or involved in a product, that was helping people. That you can measure the help. And so my attitude toward my research career was this was a better choice for me.
Now, of course, we have the human papillomavirus vaccine, the HPV vaccine, that actually prevents cervical cancer as long as it's inoculated into the person before the disease is contracted. So it's come full circle.
And
hopefully there'll be some more of those in the future.
How do patients' parents react to the request?
Depends, of course, on the parent. But we try to point out the importance for it, both for males and females.
It's needed on both sides.
Right. Thank you very much, Dr. Bernstein. We appreciate your time and effort and summarization of your lifelong profession.
Thank you for doing this.